Like a youngster who would rather skip the vegetables and get right to the pie, Lieutenant Dunbar passed over the difficult job of
shoring up the supply house in favor of the more pleasant possibilities of constructing the awning. Digging through the provisions, he found a set of field tents that would supply the canvas.
But no amount of searching would produce a suitable instrument with which to stitch, and he wished he hadn't been so quick in burning the carcasses. He scoured the banks downriver for a good part of the morning before he found a small skeleton that yielded several strong slivers of bone that could be used for sewing. Back at the supply house, he found a thin length of rope that unraveled into the thread size he had imagined. Leather would have been more durable, but in making all his improvements, Lieutenant Dunbar liked the idea of assigning a temporary aspect to the work. Holding down the fort, he thought, chuckling to himself. Holding down the fort, until it came fully to life again with the arrival of fresh troops. Though careful to avoid expectations, he was sure that sooner or later someone would come. The sewing was brutal. For the remainder of the second day, he stitched doggedly at the canvas, making good progress. But by the time he knocked off late that afternoon, his hands were so sore and swollen that he had difficulty preparing his evening coffee. In the morning, his fingers were like stone, far too stiff to work the needle. He was tempted to try anyway, for he was close to finishing, but he didn't. Instead, he turned his attention to the corral. After careful study, he cannibalized four of the tallest and sturdiest posts. They had not been sunk deep, and it didn't take much time to pull them out. Sisko wasn't going to go anywhere, and the lieutenant toyed briefly with the idea of leaving the corral open. In the end, however, he decided a non-corral would violate the spirit of the cleanup campaign, so he took another hour to rearrange the fencing. Then he spread the canvas in front of the sleeping hut and sank the posts deep, packing them tight as he could with the heavy soil. The day had turned warm, and when he was finished with the posts, the lieutenant found himself traipsing into the shade of the sod hut. He sat on the edge of the bed and leaned back against the wall. His eyes were getting heavy. He lay down on the pallet to rest a moment, and promptly fell into a deep, delicious sleep. He woke flushed, with the sensuous afterglow of having surrendered completely, in this case to a nap. Stretching out languidly, he dropped his hand over the side of the bed, and like a dreamy child let his fingertips play lightly over the dirt floor. He felt wonderful, lying there with nothing to do, and it occurred to him that in addition to inventing his own duties, he could also set his own pace. For the time being, anyway. He decided that in the same way he had surrendered to the nap, he would give himself more leeway with other pleasures as well. Wouldn't hurt to cut myself a little slack, he thought. Shadows were creeping across the hut's doorway, and curious about how long he had slept, Dunbar slid a hand inside his trousers and pulled out the simple old pocket watch that had been his father's. When he brought it to his face, he saw that it had stopped. For a moment, he considered trying to set an approximate time, but instead he placed the old, worn timepiece on his stomach and lapsed into a meditation. What did time matter to him now? What did it ever matter? Well, perhaps it was necessary in the movement of things, men and materials, for instance, for cooking things correctly, for schools and weddings and church services and going to work. But what did it matter out here? Lieutenant Dunbar rolled himself a smoke and hung the heirloom on a convenient hook a couple of feet above the bed. He stared at the numbers on the watch's face as he smoked, thinking how much more efficient it would be to work when a person felt like it, to eat when a person was hungry, to sleep when a person was sleepy. He took a long drag on the cigarette, and throwing his arms contentedly behind his head, blew out a stream of blue smoke. How good it will be to live without time for a while, he thought. Suddenly there was the sound of heavy footfalls just outside. They started and stopped and started again. A moving shadow passed over the entrance to the hut, and a moment later Sisko's big head swung through the doorway. His ears were pricked and his eyes were wide with wonder. He looked like a child invading the sanctity of his parents' bedroom on a Sunday morning. Lieutenant Dunbar laughed out loud. The buckskin let his ears fall and gave his head a long, casual shake, as if pretending this little embarrassment hadn't happened. His eyes roamed the room with a detached air. Then he looked pointedly at the lieutenant and stamped his hoof in the way horses do when they want to shake off the flies. Dunbar knew he wanted something. A ride, probably. He'd been standing around for 2 days. Lieutenant Dunbar was not a fancy rider. He'd never been schooled in the subtleties of horsemanship. His frame, deceptively strong despite being slim, had not known organized athletics. But there was something about horses. He had loved them from boyhood. Perhaps that was the reason. But the reason doesn't really matter. What matters is that something extraordinary happened when Dunbar swung onto the back of a horse, especially if it was a gifted horse like Sisko. Communication took place between horses and Lieutenant Dunbar. He had the knack of deciphering the language of a horse, and once that was mastered, the sky was the limit. He had mastered Sisko's dialect almost at once, and there was little they couldn't do. When they rode, it was with the grace of a dance team. And the purer, the better. Dunbar had always preferred a bareback to a saddle, but the army, of course, permitted no such thing. People got hurt, and it was out of the question for long campaigns. So when the lieutenant stepped inside the shadowy supply house, his hand went automatically for the saddle in the corner. He checked himself. The only army here was him, and Lieutenant Dunbar knew he would not get hurt. He reached instead for Sisko's bridle and left the saddle behind. They weren't 20 yards from the corral when he saw the wolf again. It was staring from the spot it had occupied the day before, on the edge of the bluff just across the river. The wolf had begun to move, but when he saw Sisko come to a halt, he froze, stepped deliberately back into his original position, and resumed staring at the lieutenant. Dunbar stared back with more interest than he had the day before. It was the same wolf, all right, two white socks on the front paws. He was big and sturdy, but something about him gave Dunbar the impression he was past his prime. His coat was scruffy, and the lieutenant thought he could see a jagged line along the muzzle, most likely an old scar. There was an alertness about him that signified age. He seemed to watch everything without moving a muscle. Wisdom was the word that came to the lieutenant's mind. Wisdom was the bonus of surviving many years, and the tawny old fellow with the watchful eyes had survived more than his share. Funny he's come back again, Lieutenant Dunbar thought. He pushed forward slightly, and Sisko stepped ahead. As he did, Dunbar's eye picked up movement, and he glanced across the river. The wolf was moving, too. In fact, he was keeping pace. This went on for 100 yards before the lieutenant asked Sisko to stop again. The wolf stopped, too. On impulse, the lieutenant wheeled Sisko a quarter turn and faced across the chasm. Now he was staring straight into the wolf's eyes, and the lieutenant felt certain he could read something there. Something like longing. He was beginning to think about what the longing might be, when the wolf suddenly yawned and turned away. Dunbar kicked himself into a trot and disappeared. April 13th, 1863. Though well supplied, I have decided to ration my goods. The missing garrison or a replacement should be here any time. I cannot imagine it will be too much longer now. In any event, I am striving to consume stores in the way I would if I were part of the post rather than the whole affair. It will be hard with the coffee, but I shall try my best. Have begun the awning. If my hands, which are in poor condition just now, should be up to snuff in the morning, I might have it up by tomorrow p.m. Made a short patrol this p.m. Discovered nothing. There is a wolf who seems intent on the goings-on here. He does not seem inclined to be a nuisance, however, and aside from my horse, he is the only visitor I have had. He has appeared each afternoon for the past 2 days. If he comes calling tomorrow, I will name him Two Socks. He has milky white socks on both front paws. Lieutenant John J. Dunbar, United States Army. The next few days went smoothly. Lieutenant Dunbar's hands came back and the awning went up. 20 minutes after he had raised it, when he was relaxing beneath the sprawling shade, bent over a barrel, rolling a smoke, the breeze kicked up and the awning collapsed. Feeling ridiculous, he pawed his way out from under, studied the failure for a few minutes, and hit on the idea of guide wires as a solution. He used rope for wire, and before the sun went down, Dunbar was back in the shade, with his eyes closed, puffing on another handmade cigarette while he listened to the pleasant sound of canvas flapping gently overhead. Using a bayonet, he sawed out a wide window in the sod hut and draped a scrap of canvas over it. He worked long and hard on the supply house, but except for clearing away a large part of the sagging wall, he made little progress. A gaping hole was the final result. The original sod crumbled each time he tried to build it up, so Lieutenant Dunbar covered a hole with yet another sheet of canvas and washed his hands of the rest. From the start, the supply house had been a losing business. Lying on his bunk in the late afternoons, Dunbar returned over and over to the problem of the supply house, but as the days passed, he thought of it less. The weather had been beautiful, with none of the violence of spring. The temperatures couldn't be more perfect. The air was feathery, and the breeze, which made the canvas window curtain billow above his head on these late afternoons, was sweet. The day's little problem seemed easier to solve as time went by, and when his work was finished, the lieutenant would lie back on the bunk with his cigarette and marvel at the peace he felt. Invariably, his eyes would grow heavy, and he fell into the habit of napping for half an hour before supper. Two Socks became a habit, too. He appeared at his customary spot on the bluff each afternoon, and after 2 or 3 days, Lieutenant Dunbar began to take his silent visitor's comings and goings for granted. Occasionally, he would notice the wolf trotting into view, but more often than not, the lieutenant would glance up from some little task, and there he would be, sitting on his haunches, staring across the river with that curious but unmistakable look of longing. One evening, while Two Socks was watching, he laid a fist-sized chunk of bacon rind on his own side of the river. The morning after, there was no trace of the bacon, and though he had no proof, Dunbar felt certain that Two Socks had taken it. Lieutenant Dunbar missed some things. He missed the company of people. He missed the pleasure of a stiff drink. Most of all, he missed women, or rather, a woman. Sex hardly entered his mind, but sharing did. The more settled he became in the free and easy pattern of life at Fort Sedgwick, the more he wanted to share it with someone. And when the lieutenant thought of this missing element, he would drop his chin and stare morosely at nothing. Fortunately, these lapses of spirit passed away quickly. What he might have lacked was pale in the light of what he had. His mind was free. There was no work and there was no play. Everything was one. It didn't matter whether he was hauling water up from the stream or tying into a hearty dinner. Everything was the same, and he found it not at all boring. He thought of himself as a single current in a deep river. He was separate and he was whole, all at the same time. It was a wonderful feeling. He loved the daily reconnaissance rides on Cisco's bare back. Each day they rode out in a different direction, sometimes as far as 5 or 6 miles from the fort. He saw no buffalo and no Indians. But this disappointment was not great. The prairie was glorious, ablaze with wildflowers and overrun with game. The buffalo grass was the best, alive as an ocean, waving in the wind for as far as the eyes could see. It was a sight he knew he would never grow tired of. On the afternoon before the day Lieutenant Dunbar did his laundry, he and Cisco had ridden less than a mile from the post, when by chance he looked over his shoulders, and there was Two Socks, coming along in his easy trot a couple of hundred yards back. Lieutenant Dunbar pulled up, and the wolf slowed. But he didn't stop. He veered wide, picking up his trot again. When he was abreast of them, the old wolf halted in the high grass, 50 yards to the lieutenant's left, and settled on his haunches, waiting as if for a signal to begin again. They rode deeper into the prairie, and Two Socks went with them. Dunbar's curiosity led him to perform a series of stops and starts along the way. Two Socks, his yellow eyes always vigilant, followed suit each time. Even when Dunbar changed course, zigzagging here and there, he kept up, always maintaining his 50 yards of distance. When he put Cisco into an easy canter, the lieutenant was astounded to see Two Socks ease into a lope of his own. When they stopped, he looked out at his faithful follower and tried to conjure up an explanation. Surely this animal had known man somewhere along the line. Perhaps he was half dog. But when the lieutenant's eyes swept the wilderness all about him, running unbroken toward every horizon, he could not imagine Two Socks as anything but a wolf. "Okay," the lieutenant called out. Two Socks picked up his ears. "Let's go." The three of them covered another mile before startling a small herd of antelope. The lieutenant watched the white rump pronghorns bound over the prairie until they were almost out of sight. When he turned to check Two Socks' reaction, he could no longer see him. The wolf was gone. Clouds were building in the west, towering thunderheads filled with lightning. As he and Cisco started back, Dunbar kept an eye on the storm front. It was moving toward them, and the prospect of rain made the lieutenant's face look sour. He really had to do his laundry. The blankets had started to smell like dirty socks. Lieutenant Dunbar was right in step with the time-honored tradition of predicting weather. He was wrong. The spectacular storm slipped through during the night without loosing a single drop of rain on Fort Sedgwick, and the day that broke the next morning was the purest pastel blue, air that was something for drinking, and merciful sun that toasted everything it touched without searing a single blade of grass. Over coffee, the lieutenant reread his official reports of days past and concluded he had done a pretty fair job of putting down the facts. He debated the subjective items for a time. More than once he took up his pen to cross out a line, but in the end he changed nothing. He was pouring a second cup when he noticed the curious cloud far to the west. It was brown, a dusky brown cloud lying low and flat at the base of the sky. It was too hazy to be a cloud. It looked like smoke from a fire. The lightning from the night before must have struck something. Perhaps the prairie had been set afire. He made a mental note to keep his eye on a smoky cloud and to make his afternoon ride in that direction if it persisted. He had heard that prairie fires could be huge and fast-moving. They had come in the day before, close to twilight, and unlike Lieutenant Dunbar, they had been rained on. But their spirits were not dampened in the least. The last leg of the long trek from a winter camp far to the south was finished. That and the coming of spring made for the happiest of times. Their ponies were growing fatter and stronger with each succeeding day. The march had toned everyone after months of relative inactivity, and preparations would begin at once for the summer hunts. That made them happier still, happy in the pit of each and every belly. The buffalo were coming. Feasting was right around the corner. And because this had been a summer camp for generations, a strong spirit of homecoming lightened the hearts of everyone, all 172 men, women, and children. The winter had been mild, and the band had come through it in excellent shape. Today, on the first morning home, it was a camp of smiles. Youngsters frolicked in the pony herd, warriors swapped stories, and the women mowed through their chores of breakfast with more gaiety than usual. They were Comanche. The smoke cloud Lieutenant Dunbar thought was a prairie fire had risen from their cooking pots. They were camped on the same stream, 8 miles west of Fort Sedgwick. Dunbar grabbed up everything he could find that needed washing and stuffed it in a rucksack. Then he draped the foul blankets over his shoulders, searched out a chunk of soap, and headed down to the river. As he squatted by the stream, pulling laundry out of the sack, he thought, "Sure would like to wash what I got on." But there would be nothing left to wear while everything dried. There was the overcoat. "But how stupid," he said to himself. With a little laugh, he said out loud, "It's just me and the prairie." It was a good feeling to be naked. He even laid his officer's hat aside in the spirit of the thing. When he bent toward the water with an armful of clothes, he saw a reflection of himself in the glassy surface, the first he'd seen in more than 2 weeks. It gave him pause. His hair was longer. His face looked leaner, even with the beard that had sprouted. He'd definitely lost some weight. But the lieutenant thought he looked good. His eyes were as keen as he'd ever seen them, and as though he were acknowledging his affection for someone, he smiled boyishly at the reflection. The longer he looked at the beard, the less he liked it. He ran back for his razor. The lieutenant didn't think about his skin while he shaved. His skin had always been the same. White men come in many shades. Some are as white as snow. Lieutenant Dunbar was white enough to put your eyes out. Kicking Bird had left camp before dawn. He knew his leaving would not be questioned. He never had to answer for his movements, and rarely for his actions. Not unless they were poorly taken actions. Poorly taken actions could lead to catastrophe. But though he was new, though he had been a full-fledged medicine man for only a year, none of his actions had led to catastrophe. In fact, he had performed well. Twice he had worked minor miracles. He felt good about the miracles, but he felt just as good about the bread and butter of his job, seeing to the day-to-day welfare of the band. He performed myriad administrative duties, attended to squabbles of wide-ranging import, practiced a fair amount of medicine, and sat in on the endless councils that took place daily. All this in addition to providing for 2 wives and 4 children, and all of it done with 1 ear and 1 eye cocked to the Great Spirit, always listening, always watching for the slightest sound or sign. Kicking Bird shouldered his many duties honorably, and everyone knew it. They knew it because they knew the man. Kicking Bird did not have a self-serving bone in his body, and wherever he rode with the weight of great respect. Some of the early risers might have wondered where he was going on that first morning, but they never dreamed of asking. Kicking Bird was not on a special mission. He had ridden onto the prairie to clear his head. He disliked the big movements, winter to summer, summer to winter. The tremendous clang of it all distracted him. It distracted the ear and eye he tried to keep cocked at the Great Spirit. And on this first morning after the long march, he knew the din of setting up camp would be more than he could manage. So he had taken his best pony, a broad-backed chestnut, and ridden off toward the river, following it several miles until he came to a knobby rise he had known since boyhood. There he waited for the prairie to reveal itself, and when it did, Kicking Bird was pleased. It had never looked so good to him. All the signs were right for an abundant summer. There would be enemies, of course, but the band was very strong now. Kicking Bird couldn't suppress a smile. He was sure it would be a prosperous season. After an hour, his exhilaration had not diminished. Kicking Bird said to himself, "I will make a walk in this beautiful country, and he kicked his pony into the still rising sun. He had sunk both blankets into the water before he remembered that laundry must be pounded. There wasn't a single rock in sight. Clutching the dripping blankets and the rest of the clothes against his chest, Lieutenant Dunbar, the laundry novice, wandered downstream, stepping lightly in his bare feet. A quarter mile later, he found an outcropping that made for a nice bench. He worked up a good lather, and as a novice will do, rubbed the soap rather tentatively into one of the blankets. By and by, he got the hang of it. With each article, the routine of soaping, beating, and rinsing became more assured. And toward the end, Dunbar was flying through his work with the single-mindedness, if not the precision, of a seasoned laundress. In only 2 weeks out here, he had cultivated a new appreciation for detail, and knowing the first pieces had been botched, he redid them. A scrubby oak was growing partway up the slope, and he hung his laundry there. It was a good spot, full of sun and not too breezy. Still, it would take a while for everything to dry, and he'd forgotten his tobacco fixings. The naked lieutenant decided not to wait. He started back for the fort. Kicking Bird had heard disconcerting stories about their numbers. On more than one occasion, he had heard people say they were plentiful as birds, and this gave the shaman an uneasy feeling in the back of his mind. And yet, on the basis of what he had actually seen, the hare mouths inspired only pity. They seemed to be a sad race. Those poor soldiers at the fort, so rich in goods, so poor in everything else. They shot their guns poorly. They rode their big, slow horses poorly. They were supposed to be the white man's warriors, but they weren't alert. And they frightened so easily. Taking their horses had been laughable, like plucking berries from a bush. They were a great mystery to Kicking Bird, these white people. He could not think of them without getting his mind baffled. The soldiers at the fort, for instance, they lived without families, and they lived without their greatest chiefs. With the Great Spirit in evidence everywhere, for all to see, they worshipped things written down on paper, and they were so dirty, they didn't even keep themselves clean. Kicking Bird could not imagine how these hare mouths could sustain themselves for even a year, and yet they were said to flourish. He did not understand it. He had begun this line of thinking when he thought of the fort, when he thought of going near it. He expected them to be gone, but he thought he would see anyway. And now, as he sat on his pony looking across the prairie, he could see at first glance that the place had been improved. The white man's fort was clean. A great hide was rolling in the wind. A little horse, a good-looking one, was standing in the corral. There was no movement, not even a sound. The place should have been dead, but someone had kept it alive. Kicking Bird urged his pony to a walk. He had to have a closer look. Lieutenant Dunbar dallied as he made his way back along the stream. There was so much to see. In a strangely ironic way, he felt much less conspicuous without his clothes. Perhaps that was so. Every tiny plant, every buzzing insect seemed to attract his attention. Everything was remarkably alive. A red-tailed hawk with a ground squirrel dangling from its talons flew right in front of him, not a dozen feet overhead. Halfway back, he paused in the shade of a cottonwood to watch a badger dig out his burrow a few feet above the waterline. Every now and then, the badger would glance back at the naked lieutenant, but he kept right on digging. Close to the fort, Dunbar stopped to watch the entanglement of two lovers. A pair of black water snakes were twisting ecstatically in the shallows of the stream, and like all lovers, they were oblivious, even when the lieutenant's shadow fell across the water. He trudged up the slope enraptured, feeling as strong as anything out here, feeling like a true citizen of the prairie. As his head cleared to rise, he saw the chestnut pony. In the same instant, he saw the silhouette, creeping in the shade under the awning. A split second later, the figure stepped into the sun, and Dunbar ducked down, settling onto a cleft just below the bluff's lip. He squatted on jellied legs, his ears as big as dishes, listening with a concentration that made hearing seem the only sense he possessed. His mind raced. Fantastic images danced across the lieutenant's closed eyes. Fringed pants, beaded moccasins, a hatchet with hair hanging from it, a breastplate of gleaming bone, the heavy, shining hair spilling halfway down his back, the black, deep-set eyes, the great nose, skin the color of clay, the feather bobbing in the breeze at the back of his head. He knew it was an Indian, but he had never expected anything so wild, and the shock of it had stunned him as surely as a blow to the head. Dunbar stayed crouched below the bluff, his buttocks grazing the ground, beads of cold sweat coating his forehead. He could not grasp what he had seen. He was afraid to look again. He heard a horse snicker. and sucking up his courage, peeked slowly over the bluff. The Indian was in the corral. He was walking up to Sisko, a looped length of rope in his hand. When Lieutenant Dunbar saw this, his paralysis evaporated. He stopped thinking altogether, leaped to his feet, and scrambled over the top of the bluff. He shouted out, his bellow cracking the stillness like a shot, "You there!" Kicking Bird jumped straight into the air. When he whirled to meet the voice that had startled him out of his skin, the Comanche medicine man came face to face with the strangest sight he had ever seen. A naked man. A naked man marching straight across the yard with his fists balled, with his jaw set, and with skin so white that it hurt the eyes. Kicking Bird stumbled backward in horror, righted himself, and instead of jumping the corral fence, he tore right through it. He raced across the yard, vaulted onto his pony, and galloped off as if the devil were on his tail. Not once did he look back. April 27th, 1863. Have made first contact with a wild Indian. One came to the fort and tried to steal my horse. When I appeared, he became frightened and ran off. Do not know how many more might be in the vicinity, but am assuming where there is one, there are sure to be more. Am taking steps to prepare for another visitation. I cannot make an adequate defense, but will try to make a big impression when they come again. I am still alone, however, and unless troops arrive soon, all may be lost. The man I encountered was a magnificent-looking fellow. Lieutenant John J. Dunbar, United States Army. Dunbar spent the next 2 days taking steps, many of them geared toward creating an impression of strength and stability. It might have seemed lunatic, one man trying to prepare for the onslaught of countless enemies, but the lieutenant possessed a certain strength of character that allowed for working hard when he had very little. It was a good trait, and it helped make him a good soldier. He went about his preparations as if he were just another man at the post. His first order of business was to cache the provisions. He sorted through the entire inventory, separating only the most essential items. The rest he buried with great care in holes around the fort. He stashed the tools, lamp oil, several kegs of nails, and other miscellaneous building materials in one of the old sleeping holes. Then he covered it with a piece of canvas tarp, spread several yards of dirt over the site, and after hours of meticulous landscaping, the cache looked like a natural part of the slope. He carried 2 boxes of rifles and a half dozen small barrels of gunpowder and shot onto the grassland. There he spaded up more than 20 pieces of prairie, each about a foot square, each with the sod and grass clinging to one another. At the same spot, he dug a deep hole, roughly 6 by 6, and buried the ordnance. By the end of the afternoon, he had replaced the sections of sod and grass, tamping them down so carefully that not even the most practiced eye could have detected a disturbance. He marked the place with a bleached buffalo rib, which he drove into the ground at an angle a few yards in front of the secret spot. In the supply house, he found a pair of U.S. flags, and using 2 of the corral posts as poles, he flew them, one from the roof of the supply house, the other from the roof of his quarters. The afternoon rides were pared down to short, circular patrols that he made around the fort, always keeping his post within sight. Two Sox appeared as usual on the bluff, but Dunbar was too busy to pay him much attention. He took to wearing a full uniform at all times, keeping his high-topped riding boots shining, his hat free of dust, and his face shaved. He went nowhere, not even to the stream, without a rifle, a pistol, and a belt full of ammunition. After 2 days of fevered activity, he felt he was as ready as he could get. April 29th, 1863. My presence here must have been reported by now. Have made all the preparations I can think of. Waiting. Lieutenant John J. Dunbar, United States Army. But Lieutenant Dunbar's presence at Fort Sedgwick had not been reported. Kicking Bird had kept the man who shines like snow locked away in his thoughts. For 2 days, the medicine man stayed to himself, deeply disturbed by what he had seen, struggling mightily for the meaning of what he first believed to be a nightmarish hallucination. After much reflection, however, he admitted to himself that what he had seen was real. In some ways, this conclusion created more problems. The man was real. He had life. He was over there. Kicking Bird further concluded that the man who shines like snow must be linked in some way to the fate of the band. Otherwise, the Great Spirit would not have bothered to present the vision of him. He had taken it upon himself to divine the meaning of this, but try as he might, he could not. The whole situation troubled him like nothing he had ever experienced. His wives knew there was some kind of trouble as soon as he had returned from the faithful ride to Fort Sedgwick. They could see a distinct change in the expression of his eyes. But outside of taking extra care with their husband, the women said nothing as they went about their work. There were a handful of men who, like Kicking Bird, carried great influence in the band. None was more influential than Ten Bears. He was the most venerated, and at 60 years his toughness, his wisdom, and the remarkably steady hand with which he had guided the band were exceeded only by his uncanny ability to know which way the winds of fortune, no matter how small or large, were going to shift next. Ten Bears could see at first glance that something had happened to Kicking Bird, whom he looked on as an important staff member. But he too said nothing. It was his custom, and it served him well, to wait and to watch. But by the end of the second day, it seemed apparent to Ten Bears that something serious might have happened, and late in the afternoon he paid a casual visit to Kicking Bird's home. For 20 minutes they smoked the medicine man's tobacco in silence before slipping into bits and pieces of chit-chat concerning unimportant matters. At just the right moment, Ten Bears drove the conversation deeper with a general question. He asked how Kicking Bird felt, from a spiritual point of view, about prospects for the summer. Without going into detail, the medicine man told him the signs were good. A priest who cares not to elaborate about his work was a dead giveaway to Ten Bears. He was certain something had been held back. Then, with the skill of a master diplomat, Ten Bears asked about potentially negative signs. The two men's eyes met. Ten Bears had trapped him in the most gentle way. "There is one," said Kicking Bird. As soon as he said that, Kicking Bird felt a sudden release, as though his hands had been unbound, and it all spilled out, the ride, the fort, the beautiful buckskin horse, and the man who shines like snow. When he finished, Ten Bears relit the pipe and puffed thoughtfully before laying it between them. "Did he look like a god?" he asked. "No, he looked like a man," replied Kicking Bird. "He walked like a man, sounded like a man. His form was as a man's. Even his sex was as a man's." "I have never heard of a white man without clothes," said Ten Bears, and his expression turned suspicious. "His skin actually reflected the sun?" "It stung the eyes." The men fell into silence once again. Ten Bears got to his feet. "I will think about this now." Ten Bears shooed everyone out of his lodge and sat by himself for more than an hour, thinking about what Kicking Bird had told him. It was hard thinking. He had only seen white men on a few occasions, and like Kicking Bird, he could not fathom their behavior. Because of their reputed numbers, they would have to be watched and somehow controlled, but until now they had been nothing beyond a persistent nuisance to his mind. Ten Bears never liked thinking about them. How could any race be so mixed up, he thought. But he was drifting from the point, and inwardly Ten Bears chastised himself for his messy thinking. What did he really know about the white people? He knew next to nothing. That he had to admit. This strange being at the fort, perhaps it was a spirit. Perhaps it was a different type of white man. It was possible, Ten Bears conceded, that the being Kicking Bird had seen was the first of a whole new race of people. The old head man sighed to himself as his brain filled to overflowing. There was already so much to do with the summer hunting. And now this. He could not come to a conclusion. Ten Bears decided to call a council. The meeting convened before sunset, but it lasted long into the evening, long enough to draw the collective attention of the village, especially the young men who gathered in little groups to speculate about what their elders might be discussing. After an hour's worth of preliminaries, they got down to business. Kicking Bird related his story. When he was finished, Ten Bear solicited the opinions of his fellows. They were many, and they were wide-ranging. Wind in His Hair was the youngest among them, an impulsive but seasoned fighter. He thought they should send a party immediately, a party to ride down and shoot arrows into the white man. If he was a god, the arrows would have no effect. If he was mortal, they would have one less hair mouth to worry about. Wind in His Hair would be happy to lead the party. His suggestion was rejected by the others. If this person was a god, it would not be a good idea to shoot arrows into him. And killing a white man had to be handled with a certain delicacy. A dead white man might produce many more live ones. Hornbull was known to be conservative. No one would dare to question his bravery, but it was true that he usually opted for discretion in most matters. He made a simple suggestion. Send a delegation to parley with the man who shines like snow. Wind in His Hair waited until Hornbull had finished this rather long declaration. Then he leaped on the idea with a vengeance. The gist of his speech pounded home a point that no one cared to dispute. Comanches did not send respected warriors to ask the business of a single, puny, trespassing white man. No one said much after this, and when they began again, the talk shifted to other topics, such as preparations for the hunt and the possibility of sending war parties to various tribes. For another hour, the men sifted through scraps of rumor and hard information that might have some bearing on the band's welfare. When at last they returned to the touchy question of what to do about the white man, Ten Bear's eyes were drooping, and his head began to nod. There was no point in going any further tonight. The old man was already snoring lightly as they left the lodge. The matter remained unresolved, but that did not mean action was not going to be taken. Any small, close-knit group is hard-pressed to keep secrets, and later that night, Hornbull's 14-year-old son heard his father mumble the essence of the council's discussion to a visiting uncle. He heard about the fort and the man who shines like snow, and he heard about the beautiful buckskin horse, the stout little mount Kicking Bird had described as the equal of 10 ponies. It fired his imagination. Hornbull's son could not sleep with this knowledge in his head, and late that night he crept out of the lodge to tell his two best friends what he knew, to tell of the grand opportunity he had chanced upon. As he expected, Frogback and Smiles a Lot balked at first. There was only one horse. How could one horse be split three ways? That was not much. And the possibility of a white god prowling around down there, that was a lot to think about. But Hornbull's son was ready for them. He'd thought it all out. The white god, that was the best part. Didn't they all want to take the war path? And when the time came, wouldn't they have to accompany veteran warriors? And wasn't it likely that they would see little direct action? Wasn't it likely that they would have little chance to distinguish themselves? But to ride against the white god, three boys against a god, that would be something. People might make up songs about that. If they pulled it off, the chances were good that all three would soon be leading war parties instead of just following along. And the horse? Well, Hornbull's son would own the horse, but the other two could ride it. They could race it if they wanted. Now, who can say this is not a great plan? Their hearts were already thumping as they stole across the river and cut three good mounts out of the pony herd. On foot, they led the horses away from the village, then circled it in a wide arc. When they were finally clear, the boys kicked their ponies into a gallop, and singing songs to keep their hearts strong, they rode along the darkened prairie, staying close by the stream that would take them directly to Fort Sedgwick. For 2 nights, Lieutenant Dunbar was all soldier, sleeping with one ear open. But the teenagers who came did not come like pranksters out for a thrill. They were Comanche boys, and they were engaged in the most serious action of their young lives. Lieutenant Dunbar never heard them come in. The galloping hooves and the boys' whooping woke him, but they were only sounds, melting into the vastness of the prairie night by the time he stumbled through the door of the hut. The boys rode hard. Everything had gone perfectly. Taking the horse had been easy, and best of all, they had not even seen the white god. But they were taking no chances. Gods could do many fantastic things, particularly when angered. The boys didn't stop for any backslapping. They rode full out, determined not to slow until they'd reached the safety of the village. They weren't 2 miles from the fort, however, when Sisko decided to exercise his will, and it was not his will to go with these boys. They were at a full run when the buckskin wheeled sharply away. Hornbull's son was pulled off his pony as if he'd been low-bridged by a tree limb. Frogback and Smiles-a-Lot tried to give chase, but Sisko kept running, the long lead line trailing behind him. He had true speed, and when the speed gave out, his stamina took over. The Indian ponies wouldn't have caught him if they'd been fresh. Dunbar had just gotten a pot of coffee going and was sitting morosely by the fire when Sisko trotted casually into the flickering light. The lieutenant was more relieved than he was surprised. Having his horse stolen had made him mad as a hornet, but Sisko had been stolen before, twice to be exact, and like a faithful dog, he had always found a way to come back. Lieutenant Dunbar gathered in the Comanche lead line, checked his horse for cuts, and with the sky turning pink in the east, led the little buckskin down the slope for a drink. While he sat by the stream, Dunbar watched the surface. The river's little fish were beginning to bite at the hordes of invisible insects lighting on top of the water, and the lieutenant suddenly felt as helpless as a mayfly. The Indians could have killed him as easily as they had stolen his horse. The idea of dying bothered him. I could be dead by this afternoon, he thought. What bothered him even more was the prospect of dying like an insect. He decided then and there that if he was going to die, it would not be in bed. He knew that something was in motion, something that made him vulnerable in a way that sent a chill up his spine. He might be a citizen of the prairie, but that didn't mean he was accepted. He was the new kid in school. Their eyes would be on him. His spine was still tingling as he led Sisko back up the slope. Hornbull's son had broken his arm. He was given over to Kicking Bird as soon as the bedraggled trio of would-be warriors entered the village. The boys had begun to worry from the moment Hornbull's son found that his arm would not work. If no one had gotten hurt, they might have been able to keep their botched raid a secret. But immediately there had been questions, and the boys, though they might be given to sprucing up the facts, were Comanche. And Comanches had great difficulty lying, even Comanche boys. While Kicking Bird worked on his arm, and with his father and Ten Bears listening, Hornbull's son told the truth of what had happened. It was not unusual for a stolen horse to break away from its captors and return home, but because they might be dealing with a spirit, the matter of the horse took on a great importance, and the older men questioned the injured boy closely. When he told them the horse had not spooked, that he had broken away deliberately, the faces of the elders grew noticeably longer. Another council was called. This time everyone knew what it was about, for the story of the boy's misadventure quickly became the talk of the camp. Some of the more impressionable people in the village suffered brief bouts of the jitters when they learned that a strange white god might be lurking in the neighborhood. But most everyone went about their business with the feeling that Ten Bears' council would figure something out. Still, everyone was anxious. Only one among them was truly terrified. She'd been terrified the summer before, when it was discovered that white soldiers had come into the country. The band had never met the Haramaus, except for killing several on isolated occasions. She had hoped they would never meet them. When the white soldiers' horses were stolen late last summer, she had panicked and run off. She was sure the white soldiers would come to the village, but they didn't. Still, she was on pins and needles until it was determined that without their horses, the white soldiers were practically helpless. Then she had been able to relax a little. But it wasn't until they broke camp and were on the winter trail that the awful cloud of fear that followed her all summer finally lifted. Now summer was on them again, and all along the trail from the winter camp, she had prayed fiercely for the Haramaus to be gone. Her prayers had not been answered. And once again her days were troubled, hour by hour. Her name was Stands with a Fist. She alone, among all the Comanches, knew that the white man was not a god. The story of Kicking Bird's encounter did puzzle her, however. A single, naked white man? Out here? In the Comanche homeland? It didn't make sense. But no matter. Without knowing precisely why, she knew he was not a god. Something old told her so. She heard the story that morning, on her way to the once-a-month lodge, the one set aside for menstruating women. She'd been thinking of her husband. Normally, she did not like going to the lodge because she would miss his company. He was wonderful, a brave, handsome, and altogether exceptional man, a model husband. She had never been struck by him, and though both their babies had died, one in childbirth, the other a few weeks later, he had stubbornly refused to take another wife. People had urged him to take another wife. Even Stands with a Fist had suggested it. But he said simply, "You are plenty," and she had never spoken of it again. In her secret heart, she was proud that he was happy with her alone. She missed him terribly now. Before they broke winter camp, he'd taken a large party against the Utes. Nearly a month had passed with no word of him or the other warriors. But because she was already cut off from him, going to the once-a-month lodge had not seemed as hard as usual. As she made ready to leave that morning, the young Comanche woman was comforted by the notion that a close friend or two would be sequestered with her, women with whom the time would pass easily. But on her way to the lodge, she heard of Kicking Bird's odd story. Then she heard the story of the foolish raid. Stands with a Fist's mourning had exploded in her face. Once more a great dread had settled on her square, straight shoulders, like an iron blanket, and she entered the once-a-month lodge badly shaken. But she was very strong. Her beautiful light brown eyes, eyes that shone with intelligence, revealed nothing as she sewed and chatted through the morning with her friends. They knew the danger. The whole band knew. But it served no one to talk about it, so no one did. All afternoon her tough, tiny frame moved about the lodge, showing nothing of the heavy blanket hanging over it. Stands with a Fist was 26 years old. For almost 12 of those years she had been a Comanche. Before that, she had been white. Before that she had been... what was it? She only thought of the name on the rare occasions when she could not avoid thinking about the whites. Then, for some inexplicable reason, it would pop up in front of her eyes. "Oh, yes," she thought, "Comanche. I remember it. Before, I was Christine. Then she would think of before, and it was always the same. It was like passing through an old misty curtain, and the two worlds became one, the old mingling with the new. Stans with a fist was Christine, and Christine was Stans with a fist. Her complexion had darkened over the years, and the whole of her appearance had a distinctly wild cast about it. But despite two full-term pregnancies, her figure was like that of a white woman, and her hair, which refused to grow beyond her shoulders and refused to stay straight, still held a pronounced cherry tint. And, of course, there were the two light brown eyes. Stans with a fist's great fear was well-founded. She could never hope to escape it. To a white eye, there would always be something strange about the woman in the once-a-month lodge. Something not altogether Indian. And to the knowing eyes of her own people, there was something not altogether Indian, even after all this time. It was a terrible, heavy burden, but Stans with a fist never spoke of it, much less complained. She carried it silently and with great bravery through every day of her Indian life, and she carried it for one monumental reason. Stans with a fist wanted to stay where she was. She was very happy. Ten Bears' council ended without resolution, but this was not an uncommon occurrence. More often than not, a critical council ended indecisively, thus signaling the start of a whole new phase of the band's political life. It was at these times that, should they choose to do so, people took independent action. Wind and his hair had lobbied hard for a second plan. Ride down and take the horse without harming the white man. But instead of boys, send men this time. The council rejected his second idea, but Wind and his hair was not angry with anyone. He had listened openly to all opinions and offered his solution. The solution had not been adopted, but the arguments against it had not convinced Wind and his hair that his plan was poor. He was a respected warrior, and like any respected warrior, he retained his supreme right. He could do as he pleased. If the council had been adamant, or if he put his plan into action and it went badly, there was a possibility he would be thrown out of the band. Wind and his hair had already considered this. The council had not been adamant. It had been befuddled. And as to himself, well, Wind and his hair had never done badly. So, once the council had ended, he strode down one of the camp's more populous avenues, looking in on several friends as he went, saying the same thing at each lodge. "I'm going down to steal that horse. Want to come?" Each friend answered his question with one of their own. "When?" And Wind and his hair had the same answer for everyone. "Now." It was a little party, 5 men. They rode out of the village and onto the prairie at a studied pace. They took it easy, but that didn't mean they were jovial. They rode grimly, like blank-faced men going to the funeral of a distant relative. Wind and his hair had told them what to do when they went for the ponies. "We'll take the horse, watch him on the way back, ride all around him. If there is a white man, don't shoot him, not unless he shoots at you. If he tries to talk, don't talk back. We'll take the horse and see what happens." Wind and his hair would not have admitted it to anyone, but he felt a wave of relief when they were in sight of the fort. There was a horse in the corral, a good-looking one, but there was no white man. The white man had turned in well before noon. He slept for several hours. Around mid-afternoon, he woke, pleased that his new idea was working. Lieutenant Dunbar had decided to sleep during the day and stay up with a fire all night. The ones who stole Cisco had come at dawn, and the stories he'd heard always singled out dawn as the preferred hour of attack. This way he would be awake when they came. He felt a little groggy after his long nap, and he'd perspired a lot. His body felt sticky. This was as good a time as any to get in a bath. That's why he was hunkered down in the stream with a head full of suds and water up to his shoulders when he heard the 5 horsemen thundering along the bluff. He thrashed out of the stream and went instinctively for his pants. He fumbled with the trousers before throwing them inside in favor of the big navy revolver. Then he scurried up the slope on all fours. They all got a look at him as they rode out with Cisco. He was standing on the edge of the bluff. Water was dripping down his body. His head was covered with something white. There was a gun in his hand. All this was seen in glances thrown over shoulders, but no more than that. They were all remembering Wind and his hair's instructions. With one warrior holding Cisco and the rest bunched around, they tore out of the fort in tight formation. Wind and his hair hung back. The white man hadn't moved. He was standing still and straight on the edge of the bluff, his gun hand hanging by his side. Wind and his hair could have cared less about the white man, but he cared greatly about what the white man represented. It was every warrior's most constant enemy, The white man represented fear. It was one thing to withdraw from the field of battle after a hard fight, but to let fear fly in his face and do nothing? Wind in His Hair knew he could not let this happen. He took his frantic pony in hand, swung him around, and galloped down on the lieutenant. In his wild scramble up the bluff, Lieutenant Dunbar was everything a soldier should be. He was rushing to meet the enemy. There were no other thoughts in his head. But all that left him in the moment he surmounted the bluff. He had geared himself for criminals, a gang of lawbreakers, burglars who needed punishing. What he found instead was a pageant. A pageant of action so breathtaking that, like a kid at his first big parade, the lieutenant was powerless to do anything but stand there and watch it go by. The furious rush of the ponies as they pounded past, their shining coats, the feathers flying from their bridles and manes and tails, the decorations on their rumps, and the men on their backs riding with the abandon of children on make-believe toys, their rich, dark skins, the lines of sinewy muscles standing out clearly, the gleaming braided hair, the bows and lances and rifles, the paint running in bold lines down their faces and arms, and everything in such magnificent harmony. Together the men and horses looked like the great blade of a plow rushing across the landscape, its furrow barely scratching the surface. It was of a color and speed and wonder he had never imagined. It was the celebrated glory of war captured in a single living mural, and Dunbar stood transfixed, not so much a man as he was a pair of eyes. He was in a deep fog, and it had just begun to dissipate when Dunbar realized one of them was coming back. Like a sleeper in a dream, he struggled to come awake. His brain was trying to send commands, but the communication kept breaking down. He could not move a muscle. The rider was coming fast, stampeding toward him on a collision course. Lieutenant Dunbar did not think of being run over. He did not think of dying. He had lost all capacity for thought. He stood unmoving, focused, trance-like, on the pony's dilated nostrils. When Wind in His Hair was within 30 feet of the lieutenant, he pulled up so sharply that for a moment his horse literally sat on the ground. With a great spring upward, the excited pony gained his feet and began at once to dance and pitch and whirl. Wind in His Hair held him close all the while, barely aware of the gyrations going on underneath him. He was glaring at the naked, motionless white man. The figure was absolutely still. Wind in His Hair could not see him blinking. He could see the bright white chest heaving slowly up and down, however. The man was alive. He seemed not to be afraid. Wind in His Hair appreciated the white man's lack of fear, but at the same time it made him nervous. The man should be afraid. How could he not be? Wind in His Hair felt his own fear creeping back. It was making his skin tingle. He raised his rifle over his head and roared out 3 emphatic sentences. "I am Wind in His Hair. Do you see that I am not afraid of you? Do you see?" The white man did not answer, and Wind in His Hair suddenly felt satisfied. He had come straight to the face of this would-be enemy. He had challenged the naked white man, and the white man had done nothing. It was enough. He spun his pony around, gave him his head, and dashed off to rejoin his friends.